A first-generation Nissan Qashqai.
No, not ever. Three of the doors currently unlock.
As long as it's the door that the bride gets out of, that's probably the one you need to make sure.
Sorry, you have to get out. You have to sit in the front.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Classics World Chat Show. I'm Phil Whedon and I'm joined by my stalwart partners, Jeff Ruggles.
Hello.
And Joe Miller.
Hello.
Okay, chaps. We've got into a bit of a habit of doing some of these episodes back to back for various scheduling reasons. So there's probably less to talk about in the news. So, Jeff, unless you've got any other topical events you want to share, I have something else I wanted to share with us all, which is an interesting little quiz.
Ooh, a quiz. I'll let you crack on with that, I think.
It's a contentious issue that always gets thrown up a lot in discussions whenever we mention a particular car or, you know, we broach this subject on a broader sense. But it is fundamentally, what is a classic? What constitutes a classic car?
Ooh, that's a big debate. How long have you got?
Well, exactly. You could fill an entire episode discussing and debating the pros and cons, but I thought I'd short circuit it with just a simple, I'm going to just rattle off 10 cars and I want the two of you to tell me whether you think it is a classic.
Okay. Right? Are we talking classic to be or as we speak now?
However you want to see it. Let's say as a classic. Now, we're going to start really simply, hopefully. This sets the base, all right? A BMC AD016.
Yeah, yes. Classic.
Definitely a classic. Good. That's fine. I don't think there's any disagreement on that one. A Jaguar E-Type.
Yeah, classic.
You're both looking at me going, this is the easiest quiz in the world. What on earth are you doing?
It's going to get harder, isn't it?
I'm just going for a baseline. This one was with Joe in mind. A first-generation Nissan Qashqai.
No, not ever.
Potentially. Look, would you have thought a Mark 1 Espace would have been a classic when it was...
Yeah, but they're good.
15 years old?
The Espace was
groundbreaking, but you could argue the Qashqai was as well, despite the fact that you don't like...
What's really interesting here, Joe, is that you're prejudicing your view based on the fact that you just don't like SUVs and you don't like that car.
I think, in all seriousness, I think it boils down to the fact that we're in an age now where all these little baby crossover SUVs, the Tiguans, the Qashqais, the Cougars, blah, 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 they're all the same. And I don't think the Qashqai is any more stand out than any of the others.
But Qashqai was the first, arguably.
Exactly that. Now, I know there were SUVs /4x4s before the Qashqai, but for me, the Qashqai is a significant car in as much as, one, it's made in Britain. It was developed and designed in the UK and built in Sunderland. It was a massive seller and continues to be to this day. I think it's the 20th anniversary of it next year. And I know SUVs are abhorrent to you, Joe, but actually, as a modern-day people's car, I would argue the Qashqai is the AD016 of its day.
You could argue that, or the Cortina of its day, perhaps. But it is hard at this stage, and I'll side with Joe here, to get your head around having the same nostalgic fondness for it as you would have done, say, a Cortina. And I think that's probably because your Cortina had these very obvious halo models, you know, S's and E's.
And some style.
And a Qashqai doesn't have the badge hierarchy, perhaps, in the same way, even though it does, but it's obviously more covert. It is hard to get your head around it. I'll give you that.
I think it's an odd one because I agree with you partly on that in terms of the context, but also I just can't wrap my head around the idea that one day at a classic car show, there'll be a Qashqai there and someone will go, oh, wow, look at that.
I don't know. I think at Photo, it could happen.
No, but even then, I think it's too mundane. I still think if you take one to Photo in a decade's time, you'll get directed to the visitor car park.
Yeah, but an AD016 is not a Ferrari, and yet we've all emphatically said that's a classic.
Yeah, but they're good.
But it's not about merit. I don't...
All right. I'll have to wait to the end to do this, because it will probably spoil the entirety of the segment. But just...
I'll go on to my next one, okay? I'll go on to my next one.
Let me do it.
A Jaguar XK X150.
Yes.
Future classic. Classic to be.
Emerging. Classic.
It's the same age as a Nissan Qashqai that we've just dismissed because it's a bit rubbish and...
I haven't dismissed it.
Yeah, but X150s are good.
But why are you the one to judge whether it's good or not?
Because
there will be many cars that have been panned in the past.
Well, this is the point. You're going to make me make my point early, Phil, but I want you to tell me, Joe, of a car 30 plus that isn't a classic.
30 plus, RAV4.
That's a bugger. That's my next That's my next car on the list. Toyota RAV4 Mark 1 was my next car on the list.
No, not classic.
They're 30 years old.
Yeah, but age does not make a classic. There'll be plenty of people that would argue that it doesn't matter how old it gets, an Allegro will never be a classic. I'm not saying I agree with them, but I don't think age defines a classic.
But that's really interesting, because you're saying you do think an older Allegro is a classic, but you're saying that some people will argue that it isn't. But by that definition, a RAV4 could be argued as a classic.
I think it's more likely to be a classic than a Qashqai is. The RAV4's actually got some merit.
It's interesting because you're still basing it on whether you think the car's any good, and that grows its own complexities, because that by definition is subjective.
Well, I think we could flip that. You could go for everyone. It's like cars like the Mazda Bongo and Mitsubishi Delica will have quite a strong following. Are they classics?
I think that, well, we touched on this before. I think it's if it's the kind of car that someone's taking the time to preserve for the future and as kind of...
But people are doing that with RAV4.
Yeah, but again, I think that's because there's an interest in RAV4s. I don't know anyone with an interest in Qashqais.
Yet.
Hopefully they've all gone in the bin by then.
A Mazda MX-5 NB.
Yes.
Yes, I think so.
You can. There's Halo models. There's a really strong following, of course.
So newer than the RAV4... Newer than the RAV4 that we've just, not completely dismissed, but newer than... So it's not an age thing either.
I think certain genres of car get there quicker, because an MX-5 is a leisure car, if you like.
Yeah.
Generally, that you associate with enjoyment and fun and getting out on a Sunday.
It implies the status. Yeah, no one needs an MX-5, do they?
So is it possible that if a car is sporty/desirable, it earns classic status sooner?
I think if you go after an insurance company, the answer would be yes.
Definitely. A Mark 1 Golf GTI was deemed a classic long before a standard Mark 1 Golf was. I think
MGB was a classic before it pretty much went out of production.
A Rolls-Royce Silver Seraph.
Silver Seraph? Yes, classic.
Yes.
A Mini R50.
Emerging.
You tinker you.
Emerging.
It's a very hard one for me because I've grown up with years of prejudice, not my own personal prejudice, but as an editor of a classic Mini magazine, fighting disdain for the R50 that emerged from some quarters. I would say it was. I own one of the very first. So I bought that because I thought it was a collectible. So for me, it's a classic.
Yeah, I think it's emerging.
A Lexus LS400.
Yes, classic.
Groundbreaker.
Interesting.
Did I say game changer? Hate that. I think it is.
I would agree, particularly for the first generation cars, but you could argue that even the second generation LS400 or the 430 that it became are old enough now and competent enough now. But is there a certain amount of badge snobbery that happens as well when it comes to deeming what's classic worthy?
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think what made the Lexus arguably a future classic the day it was born was the significance of it. You know, the fact it showed up the luxury car establishment, it was this billion-dollar enterprise, and it was better than everything else objectively in every single way. It's taken a long time to get there because certainly in the West, I think Japanese cars take a bit longer to acquire classic status than a lot of European stuff does. Whether that's just bias or not, I don't really understand. But LS400s now, the good ones that are left are being preserved and being restored and selling for impressive money at auctions and so on. So I think that that car is acquiring the classic status now that it truly deserves.
Final one, gents. Aston Martin Signet.
Yes. I'm gonna raise my head above here because it's just such a curiosity, isn't it?
It'll be collectible.
It is collectible already. They sell for 40 grand. They're more than a DB9 in certain quarters. You know, so what does that tell you? They're collectible. People like them. Is it? It's an important footnote, I think.
Yeah.
In the history of Aston Martin for having, what was it? It was done for emissions, wasn't it?
Yeah, it had to be done for emissions across the average for the fleet.
So, yes, I think it's quite interesting that they went down that route so they can continue to sell big-engined
V12s,
supercars, basically.
I think that
what
was
do you reason. Think? Do you think the Signet is a classic?
Well, I do, actually, for everything you just said. I think it's got the badge. I think it's got the curiosity factor. I think historically it's significant.
I mean, I have only seen about two in my entire life.
Yes, so. I think I've only ever seen one on the road. I've seen more Toyota IQs on which it's based.
Well, this is what I was going to say, is I think Toyota IQ could also be deemed a future classic, but for totally different reasons, because the IQ was such an impressive piece of, you know, it's the smallest four-seater car since the Mini, and incredibly well engineered, and just, yet it still had five-star safety. So I think the IQ, you could argue that as being a future classic. The Signet, I think, like you say, the rarity and the curiosity value is going to be what earns that classic status. Whether it deserves it or not, it's going to get it.
I really is. As the point I was coming back to earlier, it's like an age thing. I honestly do find it hard to make a case for certain cars not being classics over a certain age. I mean, I think age does play a factor. I mean, my friend had a Yugo Sana. Like, a lot of people will be like, oh, that's not a classic. But it was the attention it gathered at classic car events, shows and things like that. I think it was a classic. So it's like, despite being one of like three left or something.
I very deliberately chose a list that spanned different ages, different nameplates, and different types of car. Because I think what that little exercise proved to me is that it isn't simply a case of if a car's a certain age, it's a classic, because we've already seen different ages there. If it's a particular silhouette of a car, if it's a sports car or a saloon car or an SUV, does that change it? Is rarity a factor? Is desirability a factor? And you talk about competence, Joe, like being a good car or a bad car.
I think, I think if someone is willing to preserve a car for history and for the future, for more than just keeping it going in terms of like as a passion project, then you've got to be teetering on classic territory already. There is no hard and fast right and wrong answer to this.
No, there is an interesting sort of subculture that's emerged over the last decade, you could say, about unloved classics.
Oh, yeah.
It's a huge subject, isn't it? And one that we're never, ever going to reach a consensus.
Well, safe to say, gents, I might come up with another list of 10 in a future episode, and we'll put this to the test again, because I think that was quite an interesting tennis match. I quite enjoyed that. But
excellent.
But anyway, let's move on to our buying choice. And perhaps inspired by last week's episode, Joe, where you talked about your Ashes to Ashes Audi Quattro.
Yes.
TV icon. It got me thinking about defining cars of the 1980s.
I must have missed the defining bit. I thought it was just ones that we liked. Sorry.
If it defined you, it defined. It's fine.
It defines me. Yeah, I'm not sure it defines anyone
you
else.
You can argue it either way, sir, so don't worry.
The 80s are in at the moment, and even if it's not your era, you can well see some appeal in even certain cars of that time. So I think this is, you could make a case for the 80s being the most universally appealing era for cars, because it was this really exciting time when they were changing so much, and it was some of the old and some of the new, and a lot of new technology coming. Yeah, you could make a good case for the 80s being a peak era for cars in many ways.
80s is definitely the sweet spot, because I think even if you're an old guard person that probably prefers an E-Type or an old Mini, you can still get on board with the 80s stuff.
100%.
But if you're a younger person, you can still get on board with the 80s stuff, because it's old enough and quirky enough to be interesting, but modern enough to be perhaps reliable. And, you know, that's why you see things like JDM stuff really coming to prominence. So
with
yeah.
that in mind.
Yes, with that in mind, Jeff, start us off with your 1980s choices, defining or otherwise.
I've chosen a car, British car from the 1980s, which uses mechanicals from much older, from a bygone era. But it's the MG Metro. Now I love an MG Metro, so no excuses here. Specifically, the Turbo, which came out 6 months after the MG 1300 in 1982. A little bit of assistance from Lotus, only 93 horsepower, but the race cars would have 200 plus. They had to limit it because the four-speed gearbox wasn't quite up to the power potential of the Turbo. But I'd have a totally bog-standard one, a Mark II probably, post-facelift car, because I think they look cooler. Weirdly, if it was a non-Turbo, I'd have a Mark I.
Very good.
They're very cool, by the way, with the big valance and the big Turbo graphics. They're so
absolutely
cool.
Yeah.
I think,
and they're not cheap anymore.
No.
Unfortunately, I was looking at some recent sales, and you're looking around £9,000 to £12,000. Although a couple of years back, Historics had a Mark One, £22,400.
Oh,
yes, nostalgia is a powerful thing. What really irks me is that when I was a student, I could have bought one on Elm Grove in Brighton for £200, and I sidestepped it for the 1300 Clubman he had, because I thought that would be more reliable. And I've sort of beaten myself up for that ever since, really.
You were apologising for sort of whether it's a defining car or not, but MG or otherwise, the Metro, I think, is a defining car of the 80s, actually. You know, it absolutely was the firing gun for the resurgence of kind of a post, you know, BL apocalypse from the 70s. You know, there was so much fervour around the Metro when it was first launched, and those MG cars only added that sprinkle on top to make an already highly regarded car even more so.
Well, I think they thought that the MG would account for about 10% of sales, and it was quickly over a quarter.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so brilliant.
Also, it just speaks of that brashness of the era, doesn't it? The big air dam and the turbo graphics and the red seat belts and the boost. Yeah, it's cool. I'm sorry.
Yeah, a boost gauge in the on the earlier cars, I had a boost gauge in the roof lining, which seems terribly unsafe to me, but there you go.
There you go. Yeah, very,
very
cool.
Good choice. Go on then, Joe.
So my first 80s choice, by comparison, very subtle, quite understated, but just defining of the era, and it is unsurprisingly coming from me, the Mercedes W124, which is when the brand was arguably at its strongest, when a Mercedes was a Mercedes, built like a tank. The Bruno Sacco styling for me has aged so well. An early 124 on the ginger caters with the steel wheels and those flat trims on it just looks classy and stylish. And we can attest to the fact they're well built. We drove one for 24 hours straight. Everything Mercedes could do to build the best car in the world, they took the 123, which arguably was the best car in the world, just made everything 10% better. And thus you have the same car for the 1980s. And the fact they've aged so well, they're so classy, they're still a lovely thing to drive. They've got everything from coupes to estates to saloons to cabriolets and diesels and petrols and fast ones and frugal ones and different body kits if you want to go down that route. And they're just wonderful. And unlike a lot of 80s stuff, they're still relatively affordable. You can still get into one for a few grand and you could have it as a car for life. They're just wonderful things. And again, the argument goes on as to whether that or the 123 is peak Mercedes. So yeah, I find it hard to choose on that one. They're lovely cars.
It's a really good choice. And like you say, it's still one that stacks up today as a daily driver. You know, you can
The only reason I don't have one is because I got a 123. That's basically it.
Well, my first choice is very similar to, in terms of style, in terms of Jeff's first one with the MG Metro, and that is the Mark III Escort XR3. We've done road tests on XR3Is and things, and we know that they're not necessarily the best of the breed. If you wanted a car that probably summed up ambitious, yuppie 80s era, the Escort XR3i is kind of it, because it was probably those sort of ambitious, upwardly mobile bankers and boy racers alike were happy to buy something like an XR3i. So I think it embodies sort of brashness and boldness, hubris, if you like, of that era. It's not the best hot hatch, but I think it's probably one of the most iconic of that era.
Yeah. They look great as well, don't they? With the closed-loop wheels and this.
I'll fly the flag for the Golf all day long, but I think the Escort is a better looking car. The XR3 is just you could say it's objectively cool, I think.
I think with just clever marketing and a few little touches, they made it such a great halo car that people wanted, even though, as we've discussed millions of times, it's not quite as good as a Golf, but it just has a kind of amazing nostalgic lure about it.
Jeff, what's your second choice?
So, trying to vary the budget a little bit here, I have gone for a very, very nice performance saloon from BMW, the original E28M.
Yeah.
They obviously had the M535 at the time with the E28 range, but this has the development of the old M1 engine, 182 horsepower, making it the fastest production saloon on sale at the time. It's just cool, isn't it? It's just a complete barnstormer and rare, exclusive, super quick.
Whole sharp nose era of BMW. So not just the E28, but you know, the 6 series and the 7 series and things. That is absolute peak 80s, isn't it? I think
2,241 were made.
Yeah, that's so cool, that car. Again, I remember there was one at Rustival last year or the year before, and again, it got so many looks. So great choice. Yeah, I applaud that.
Very good. What about you, Joe?
I'm going to carry on with the hot hatch theme. Obviously, we've had the MG Metro as the underdog. We've had the XR3 as kind of the style icon of the era. And I've got one that kind of blends both. It's not the Golf, because much though I love the Golf GTI, it's technically a 70s car. And it's not the 205 GTI, because I mention that in every other podcast we do. No, it's not necessarily the best hot hatch of the time, but for me, it is possibly, again, one of the most defining, and that is the Renault 5 GT Turbo, gentlemen.
Brilliant.
Just, again, objectively quite a flawed car. You know, the steering's a little bit heavy, it's a bit turbo laggy, it suffers with a bit of fuel evaporation, the ride's a bit hard, blah, 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 the plastics are rattly, but it looks super cool, arguably as cool as the Escort, and it is such a fun thing to drive. It puts the biggest smile on your face. A few years back, we drove one for a video, and everywhere we went, you got people giving it a thumbs up, and I used to have one of those. It evokes that emotion. that so many of these 80 top hatches do, and it's perfectly imperfect, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
I think they look fabulous, and actually I love the interior. I love that three spoke steering wheel. It's just mega. I love them.
I mean, don't get me wrong,
we did a feature recently on run out ones, and it covered the Raider, which was the sort of all metallic blue version with the Raider sticker on the back window and the blue wheel to go with it. And I think that would be my choice.
Dare I say, I'd probably have that over a 205 GTI and things. So, you know, hate me in the comments if you like, but I think
maybe we need to do a video. Maybe we need to do a video
one day. If you've got a 205 1.9 GTI and a Renault 5 GT Turbo, particularly a Raider model, bring them on down. We'd love to do that little twin test.
Drop us a comment. Yeah, fabulous. Go on, Mr. Whedon. What's choice number two for you?
Well, I've also tried to mix up the different types of car from the 80s, because the temptation to just go loads of hot hatches would be quite high, because hot hatches were probably supreme in the 80s, right? But I've gone for the Porsche 944.
Ooh, great shout.
The 944 embodies that 80s period. And again, that yuppie period that I sort of think of. And it's so distinctive. If you wanted sort of to represent Porsche in the 80s, I think almost the 944 speaks louder than a G-Series 911, almost. Do you know what I mean?
It's just,
it's when Porsche tries to sort of modernize and become a bit more populist, maybe. And that became, therefore, the poster Porsche of choice rather than the iconic 911.
And they still look stunning, don't they? Again, like you say, it's so 80s with the big box arches and the big deep balance and the pop-up. Like, I think you could call that car objectively pretty. Fabulous.
Your final choice, Jeff.
Well, I've had a hot hatch, or warm hatch at least, and a hot saloon, so I'm going for a little sports car this time, and that is the Mark 1 Toyota MR2.
Chef's kiss.
Very little mid-engined 1.6 16 valve, really cool mid-engine handling, all that sort of thing, but also turnkey reliability, melding two things that were sometimes kept apart in the past. So they do rot.
Ooh, do they?
Really badly. Five figures for something really tidy, sort of a lame facelift car. But I quite like the earlier cars with the kind of cubist wheels and two-tone paint.
Yeah, they're the ones that have. They're cool.
The one I would really want is the model we didn't get here, which was the supercharged Mark 1.
Well, yeah.
But Evoque Classics currently have one for sale, actually, and it's £14,500. But it is lovely. Yeah.
A very good choice. A very good choice. Right, go on in, Joe.
So my final choice for an 80s icon, I went for what you, again, I hate the phrase most iconic, because that's not technically correct, but I'm going to go with it. I would say you could define it as the most iconic 80s car, and yet objectively, it's a bit crap. Of course, I am talking about the DeLorean DMC-12, the famous stainless steel bodied car that was in Back to the Future, Time Machine, you have to get that part in, which had everything going for it in terms of the man behind the company. It had Lotus chassis engineering and this clever construction. But objectively, they're a bit terrible. They're built badly. They're slow. They're heavy. They're wallowy. A lot of them are automatics, which made them even worse. That PRV engine sounds great, but it's actually really quite weedy in terms of power output. And because of their cult status, they are hugely expensive these days. And arguably, they don't deliver the driving experience to match it. But it defined 80s cars. Even if you're not into cars, you drive onto the road and people go, oh, DeLorean. They still know it's transcended car culture to general pop culture, largely because of Back to the Future. But it's undeniably unique and stylish and cool and terrible, but so were a lot of things of that era. So I wouldn't wear a pair of red braces these days, but there's no denying it's part of the era's style. And it's the same with the DeLorean. I won't ever defend it as a good car, but as an icon, you can't not call it that.
And maybe, again, we talked about the brashness of the 80s. Maybe that's what the DeLorean represents, that, you know, ambition over substance and...
Yeah, there's no bigger crowd puller, I don't think.
They're commanding big money these days. You can pay 60 or 70 grand for a really mint one. I think a lot of that is down to Back to the Future influence. Would it be as iconic and as famous were it not for that film? Probably not. But
I don't think there's any probably about it, to be honest.
No, exactly. But talking about it as a culture icon of the 80s, it's arguably one of the worst cars of the 80s, but it's also the icon. And I think it's indefensible.
Yes. Well, very good. I don't disagree with that choice at all. So I kind of kept nudging up the price scale with my final choice, because I went with a Ferrari 308, a car of the 80s, more for its TV appearances, you know, like it was in Magnum and, you know, other such TV shows. And I just think it's just very much of its era, really. Again, that sort of really glamorous kind of high-end stuff, peak automotive ambition in the day. And it was certainly a poster car for me. I think of having a black ash framed picture of one, not even a poster, but these sort of black ash frames were all the rage in the 80s. It's that kind of era.
I think because 308 is technically 70s, isn't it?
Exactly,
it's an icon of the 80s era. It's a bit like the R107. You think of it more as an 80s car because that was when it was at its...
Exactly time. That.
And it was developed, you know, you got the Quattro Valvoli engine, didn't it?
Yes.
So Jaguar XJS, you arguably is an 80s car. There we go, I got my Jag reference in.
Yeah.
that was obviously a 70s car, but feels like it got more famous in the 80s. So... Yeah, the Ferrari 308 sort of falls into that camp, really. But yes, definitely a car I again associate with the glorious hedonistic excesses of the 80s.
Hedonistic. There you go. There's your word of the day.
Yeah, there we go. I did it just for the pleasure of it. But anyway, so what are we up to in the near future? So yes, stuff on the horizon that you can look forward to.
By the time you watch this, I will be on holiday. That's what I'll be looking forward to.
Is this a car-related holiday, Jeff, like your IMM jaunt, or is it actually a family?
No, event? this is a family holiday. That said, I'm going to a destination where there's always lots of interesting cars on the roads. Quite pleased. Yeah. So on the Croatian coast, you often see some interesting classics.
Brilliant. Good. Very good.
You know, old BMWs, Golfs, that sort of thing. I'm really looking forward to seeing those.
Nice.
Yeah, look forward to the holiday snaps.
What about you, Joe?
If all goes to plan, this weekend I'm going to be elbows deep in my W123 because it's going to be playing the role of wedding car at the end of July. And not for me, I should add, it's for some friends of mine. But to do that, to get it ready for that, there's a few bits it needs. So it's getting a new drive shaft because we think one of the drive shafts is on its way out. It needs some new rear drop links and three of the doors currently unlock. So we need to sort the fourth one out. It's all fairly trivial stuff, but it's stuff that if you're doing a wedding, you kind of need to work.
I was going to say, as long as it's the door that the bride gets out of, that's probably the one you need to make sure.
Sorry, you have to get out. You have to sit in the front.
You have to climb over.
But yeah, exactly. Just shuffle over enough. Don't worry about the dress. But yeah, so that's my plan, is wedding car prep for the 123. And that's about it, really. If the weather's all prevailing, then we keep using the bike, as I say every week, because I'm loving using the bike at the minute. But what about you, sir? Are you chiseling the grime off your Rover this weekend?
Maybe. It might be a quiet weekend, actually, in all fairness, because we are getting ready for the weekend after for Stars and Stripes show at Tatton Park, a big celebration of classic American machinery. Our editor of Classic American magazine, Paul Guinness, is going to be there. Yes, I'm probably going to keep my powder dry for that weekend and have a bit of a weekend off, to be honest. But yeah,
we'll just flag it.
If the sun is shining, the Rover might get an airing.
I will just flag that in Classic Car Buyer this week, there are, to coincide with Stars and Stripes, there is a selection of American cars that are easy to own in the UK. So please take
lovely. That. There we go. I must, as my shameless plug of the week, also just give a shout out to another one of our lesser-known bookazines that we produced actually some time ago. I think this over the kind of COVID period a few years ago, but we do still have them in stock. And that is, we've got a series of books called The Best of British Leyland, which... In previous episodes, you might not think that's even a thing. Yes, there's a Best of British Leyland book, which we'll put a link in the description, because there's actually a whole series that celebrates a lot of those BL icons of that period. So if you're into that kind of bread and butter stuff, do go and check it out. But anyway, that's our final segment of this week's episode, is our Want of the Week, gentlemen. So a car that's caught our eye. And yes, as ever, there's never any shortage of inspiration. So, Jeff, what's caught your eye this week?
A British Leyland icon. It's almost like set this up, hasn't it?
Well done. Thank you.
A British Leyland icon. I was at the Beauty Mini Day a couple of weeks ago. I may have mentioned it. So there's my Mini reference. I think it's the first one. And in amongst all the Minis was a Mimosa Yellow Dolomite Sprint.
Nice.
And it just caught my eye. And I'm not really being able to stop considering one since. Love the colour palette they have, you know, especially the early colours. Mimosa Yellow, as I mentioned, and also Magenta, that kind of purple that they came in. Really, really cool. See, the first volume produced 16-valve car. Kind of nice combination of power and a little bit of class as well. You still get the nice trims.
That'd be a really nice companion to your various Minis, I think. That's very cool.
Yeah, they look good on the GK and alloy wheels that they came on. And sort of another first, really. just like the way they look.
Good choice. I like that. What about you, Joe?
So last week or the week before, as you listened to this, I've visited our good friends at Kim Cairns up in Norfolk. It's a fairly regular haunt for me because I love that part of the country and we love visiting them. They always have some great cars in. Amongst other cars I drove up there, I got the chance to sample a 2CV that they have in stock. It's a fairly late car. It's a mid-80s, I think. It's a French import in bright yellow. I can't remember for the life of me the name of the yellow off the top of my head, but bright yellow.
It's a 2CV, isn't it? A special.
That's it. That's right, yes. So it was originally a 400cc or 435. It's had extensive work done to it. It's had a galvanized chassis, full restoration. It's had it swapped out to a 602cc engine from a 2CV6 with a rebuilt gearbox on it. And even though it was on a really gloomy, miserably rainy day, actually, at one point I could barely see where I was going, it was wonderful. I haven't driven a 2CV in some time, and this one was a sweetie. It felt so tight and up and together. The engine felt strong. The gearbox was lovely. And there's nothing like, you can't drive a 2CV and not smile. Just the floaty suspension, and that if you fling it into a corner, you can get it leaning over properly. And once you've got the hang of the weird gear change on them, there's a real novelty to that as well. I loved it. It just made me, I probably didn't go faster than about 35 miles an hour, but it was just wonderful. Just made me smile. And that, yeah, I came back home and found myself doing a Jeff and looking on French classifieds and trying to find one. Complimented further by yesterday on the motorway, I saw a beautifully patinated Ripple bonnet, an early car. It looked like it had been oiled or something because of all the little patches of brown just dotted all over it. Not rust, just weathering and patination. And it's one of those cars like a Land Rover that wears its age on its sleeve best. It's just beautiful cars. And there are a few cars that will make me smile as much as a 2CV. So I would like one of those very much.
Very good. Well, I just misread my notes and thought I'd written down Nissan Qashqai, but that was part of the earlier quiz.
Well, thanks for that.
You'll be pleased to know that I've stayed true to form, and one of my wants this week has been looking at Jaguars again. This time I was trying to find the most interesting sub $5,000 Jaguar I could sort of, and
okay,
that's where I was going with. Anyway, lots of choice, actually, surprising amount of choice. One that I thought really caught my eye, I'm going to just sort of shout up to the camera here. It's a fairly late X308 Jaguar XJ. It's a 3.2 Sport 2002 model. The reason that's significant is that it's one of the very last of that 308 body shell. The 3.2 Sport at that point was then given the earlier XJR wheels. So it looks a little bit sporty, even though it's the slightly sluggish 3.2. In day-to-day traffic, it's absolutely fine. I love the sort of retro styling. And for $2,500, that looked like a bit of a steal to me.
Definitely.
So if it's not sold already, I may well try and buy it. But we'll see. We probably need to wrap up because Jeff needs to go. So
yeah, no, I need to go and get myself a shirt to match you two.
Yeah, we go. Yes, I just realised we're the Shepherd twins today.
For those of you listening, not watching, Phil and I are both glorious in plaid this afternoon.
Yes, exactly, the lumberjack twins. But I must just say, I do please keep commenting. If you're watching it on YouTube, we do invite you to drop comments below because it's great to hear your interactions. I must just give a quick shout out to people that commented on our estate chat a couple of weeks ago. We had some great suggestions. Skoda Octavia RS, Citroen CX, BX and XM estates were also flagged. An E34 BMW 5 Series was listed, as was an Audi RS6, a Honda Aero deck and a Mazda 929 estate.
Wow!
Those were just some of the suggestions that came off the back of our estate chat. So I urge you, if you're watching on YouTube, drop us a comment because we love to hear your suggestions. And if you're listening on a podcast platform of choice, give us a follow and a rating and help spread the word because we do enjoy having these chats every week. And we hope you can join us same time again next week. In the meantime, thanks very much and we'll see you again soon.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.